from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, sneakers and why some people are obsessed with them. They covet them, collect them, auction them, and preserve them. The Oakland Museum of Art has a new exhibit that celebrates the rubber-soled shoes, its evolution from functional to fashionable, and its role in popular culture from hip-hop to the NBA. Join us as we examine the rise of sneaker culture. Next on Forum, after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The Oakland Museum's new exhibit, Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture, includes dozens of iconic sneakers from PF Flyers to Nike's First Air Jordans to Reebok Pumps. Why is something mass-produced and worn by many an object worthy of an art museum? Because these once purely functional rubber soles have played central roles in American popular culture and in our economy. The multi-billion dollar industry has also spawned a billion dollar resale market, where rare sneakers can be sold for thousands. But besides that, these shoes have stories to tell about the way we understand class, race, masculinity, even ourselves. At least that's been the experience of our guests in this hour of Forum on this Friday morning. And let me tell you who they are. We're joined by Elizabeth Semmelhack. She's curator of The Rise of Sneaker Culture, which is now at the Oakland Museum of California, and senior curator at the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto. Good morning, Elizabeth Semmelhack.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And thanks to Michael Denzel Smith. He's author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. He's also an Alfred Knobler Fellow at the Nation Institute. Good morning, Michael Denzel Smith.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And thanks also to Stephen Smith, design director at Yeezy Lab, Kanye West's collaboration with Adidas. He's also designed footwear for Fila, Reebok, Adidas, and Nike, and worked on iconic shoes like the Reebok Instapump Fury, the Air Max, and New Balance 574. Elizabeth Semmelhack, let me start with you. The exhibit you curated features sneakers from the 1800s to 2015. Can you describe some of the most iconic ones in your collection?
Well, I think that actually almost every single piece in that exhibition is iconic. So if you think about the incredible numbers of sneakers that have been produced over the years, it was hard to try to sort of just condense
choose,
it down to the few that we needed. And so even though 150 plus sneakers seem like a lot, each one really was chosen because they are central to the story of the history of the sneaker.
And I saw there were even models that women wore of these rubber soles that were heeled back in the day.
Correct. And so, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do with the exhibition was to take it all the way back to the origin of the sneaker because, you know, maybe with the exception of Crocs, sneakers really are one of the newest forms of footwear that has been invented. And so I wanted to start out way as far back as I could and consider its origin. And one of the misconceptions that I hope the exhibition sort of addresses is that sneakers actually started out as status items. Rubber, pardon me, was a very expensive material. And so not only were early sneakers expensive in and of their own right, you had to be able to afford two pairs of shoes. And even more importantly than that, you needed to be able to afford the time to play, which in a pre-unionized 40-hour work week, many people did not have that privilege. So sneakers start out as status items related to privilege. And So I wanted to chart that history from their rise, their fall, which really happens in the post-World War II moment, to their rise again and the importance of sneakers culturally at the moment.
Yes, walking through the exhibit, you start to realize how the sneaker follows certain cultural shifts. You talked about post-World War II, but then there was the rise of physical education during the Kennedy years that brought back the sneaker, the jogging craze in the 1970s, the punk trend that made black canvas Chuck Taylor so popular, and then the hip-hop and aerobics trend of the 1980s. You've got those pink Reebok Velcro high tops that I'd forgotten all about until we walked through that exhibit a short time ago. But I think one of the sections that really stands out, of course, is the section devoted to Nike's Air Jordan line. You have dozens of models there from 1984 to 2008. And Michael Denzel Smith, is that your favorite shoe if you had to pick one, the Nike Air Jordan line?
The Nike Air Jordan line, the Nike Air Jordan 1, to be specific, would be my favorite, not just in terms of design itself, but the significance of the shoe, what it represents culturally to me.
And talk about
and
that.
What I mean, you know, what we have, I mean, there's no sneaker culture without Michael Jordan and the Air Jordan line. I think that, you know, there would be still maybe a popular thing, but there's not necessarily there's not the blogs, there's not the resale market. All of these things are a byproduct of the popularity of Michael Jordan and the Michael Jordan sneaker. And it became like a status symbol. It was in so many different ways particularly for young black people, this way that you could be associated with a level of greatness that we hadn't seen up until that point. And you could own that. You could own a piece of that. But also it required that you have the money to be able to purchase it. So a lot of the early influencers who wore the Air Jordans were in black communities were people who were drug dealers who had the money to be able to purchase these shoes. And they were, I mean, and then, you know, people who were looking up to them because they were the ones with money and wanted to emulate them were seeking out these sneakers. And I mean, the story, you know, of Michael Jordan, that first Air Jordan being banned by the NBA, gives it this rebellious ethos to it, that you're doing something in defiance of a system, people trying to stifle your creativity or individuality. And there's Michael Jordan himself, who just embodies a certain form of black masculinity and black cool that everyone wants a piece of. So, I mean, it's huge. There's so many things intertwined there that make it so appealing to so many.
We have a clip of a commercial about the Air Jordan ones, the early black and red versions of them that were banned by the NBA in 1985, and how Nike really used that to its advantage.
Yo, Mars Blackman here with my main man, Michael Jordan. Yo, Mike, what makes you the best player in the universe? Is it the vicious dunks?
No, Mars.
Is it the haircut?
No, Mars.
Is it the shoes?
No, Mars.
Is it the extra long shorts?
No, Mars.
Is the shoes it, right?
Nah.
Is it the short socks?
No, Mars.
Money's gotta be the shoes.
Shoes?
Shoes.
Shoes.
Shoes. You sure it's not the shoes?
I'm sure, Mars.
What about the shoes?
No, Mars.
Money's gotta be the shoes.
Here's that commercial where Spike Lee showed up in Nike commercials with Michael Jordan to advertise the Air Jordans, playing the fictional character Mars Blackman. Here's the other clip of the NBA's ban.
On September 15th, Nike created a revolutionary new basketball shoe. On October 18th, the NBA threw them out of the game. Fortunately, the NBA can't stop you from wearing them. Air Jordans from Nike.
And there is some mythology around whether or not the NBA actually paid the $5,000 fine every time Michael Jordan wore those shoes. But Stephen Smith, Michael Denzel Smith brought up the design of the shoe as well in terms of it being sort of out there and challenging. Can you talk about how revolutionary that red and black design was? Stephen Smith, are you there? Oh, I'm not sure what happened to Stephen Smith. We'll try to get him back on the line. In the meantime, Michael Denzel Smith, one of the things that happened with this particular shoe, besides the fact that it became really meaningful in terms of identity, right, among Black youth and Black male youth, it also started to be associated with symbolizing almost like messed up values. Michael Denzel Smith.
Yeah, yes. I mean, that's going to happen with pretty much anything associated with Black youth, right? Like, whatever we decide is meaningful to us is somehow then pathologized as what's wrong with us, why we can't, why we're not more educated, why we don't, excel in the job market. It's because all of a sudden we have an obsession with the way that we look and the sneakers that we wear, and all we want to do is spend our money on that. It's pure racism, right, at its core. But it's also not reflective of the fact that, like, American culture is a consumer culture, right? And you buy things to reflect what you want your status to be perceived as. And Black youth are American, and they want to feel a part of that experience. The thing is that they want to own their own – they want to own their individuality. And the sneakers were a space to be able to carve that out. And it's also a reflection of, like, it's a pushback against that, right? So what you buy the sneakers that Michael Jordan is wearing, or Charles Barkley is wearing, or Penny Hardaway is wearing, and it's not just that the sneaker looks cool, it's representative of that player and who they are on the court, and the level of cool that they have, the level of power, the level of success, the level of defiance. I mean, if you wear Charles Barkley's, like, someone might think that you're actually going to curse them out, right? Because that's who Charles Barkley was on the court. Blackness has never fit into the mainstream of American society when it is being represented as a rebellion too, then you have this sort of pathologizing around why young black people want these sneakers. They don't want to be a part of the dominant culture, which means then if they don't desire that, then they must be deviant, they must be delinquent, they must be up to no good.
And you said that it was pure racism. You also had President Obama and Bill Cosby talking about how parents shouldn't be spending, hundreds of dollars on shoes and instead should be spending them on books. So they were playing into that as well.
Internalized racism is real. the idea, and it's because there's a certain... There's a certain thing. I mean, we've come to recognize it sort of as this phrase coined by the historian Evelyn Higginbotham, politics of respectability, which starts out meaning one thing around the level of engagement or type of engagement with activists, particularly women's club groups in the 30s and 40s, around saying, well, if we present ourselves in a certain way, if we are clean, if we are articulate and educated, then the structures of segregation and racism will have no choice but to fold, because there'll be no more justification for it, right? And so that's been an ideology that has expressed itself in the Black community over and over again, is that if we just get ourselves right, and if we fix our presentation to comport with the mores of the dominant culture, then we will be able to fit in. We will overcome this racist system. But that's never been true. The system of racism always adapts to new forms and adapts in new ways, and maintains itself. But also what that means then is you're taking away from the culture that has been built in response to the existence of that system to carve out one's own space and one's own sense of identity and a reclamation of humanity. And sneakers are a part of that, whether we like it or not. And Yeah, they're expensive, right? Like that. I mean, that's true. I have lots of them. They are very expensive, and yeah, like you could make an argument that those resources could be spent on something else. But then you're denying people the ability, one, of self-expression, but also just a nice luxury item to be able to face all of this oppression that one does on a daily basis, right? Like, this makes you feel a bit better about going out into the world, knowing that you can walk taller and more confident, feeling attached to what the sneaker represents.
Stephen Smith, would you say that it was Air Jordans that really were the shoe that turned sneakers from an athletic shoe into a piece of cultural identity?
I would say that they definitely broke the barrier on the colors. I think if you look at the bigger picture of all of society, Casual Friday at that point in time and the post-Wall Street era, or the Reagan era, relaxed standards, and then you had the influence of things like Miami Vice and Phil Collins. You know, Phil Collins showed up in these white leather sneakers, and that really kind of blew people's mind, combined with a pair of khakis and a jacket. I mean, I never wore that, but I mean, that broke down that barrier and made sneakers even greater in the mainstream. You would see the women in New York when Reebok fitness shoes first came out that wear their Reeboks on the subway from home, and then the second they get to the office, they'd switch in their heels. I think it was just a whole cultural relaxation and an escape from that uptight button-down shirt, necktie, you know, big business aesthetic that occurred at that time. And that, combined with the city kids adopting the sneakers as a badge of honor. I mean, where I grew up, we had Adidas with the big Boston Southie shoes that you identified with. And even later when I worked at Adidas in the 80s, we catered certain shoes to certain areas of the country because we knew, you know, at least always sell there. And then even as you got into the minutia of the product mix, even further in Southie, where you had the Irish kids in Boston, they wore green suede gazelles, and it became, you know, similar to what the inner city kids were after, was this identity. You know, it's like when you went there, you know, crap, there's, you know, there's a Southie Irish gang kid and his green gazelle, so you're kind of like, all right. So I think they definitely became an identity of sorts, and Jordan definitely helped bring it up to that next tier of an elite class to what happened with the sneakers themselves.
When you're designing one of these shoes, what are you thinking about? What is your approach?
You know, for me personally, I've always looked at it, how can I make it better, not just new and different, and better in performance, better in fit, better in comfort, better in materials, better in quality. And it goes against what some of the companies are after. You know, a lot of the times they're after, okay, I need to increase my margin points, I need to answer to Wall Street, I need to make it more profitable. And it goes counter to what the message they try to say is, like, you know, we're the best. And it's like, well, you know, I always tried to prove it. Okay, I've given this much amount of money, where can I trade off something and some other material to make this thing perform better and work better? And I've always tried to do that, to give the consumer and athlete something better. And that always drove me to create product that performed well. You know, when I worked on a track spike, I knew that it was for Olympic or pro-level athlete. And at the end of the day, the last thing to contact the ground and their only piece of equipment besides their body is their shoes. And if you screw up the shoe, you screw up their career for 4 years for an Olympic event. You know?
Speaking of the track spike, Elizabeth Semmelhack, I love that you had the original Nike waffle shoe that was created by Bill Bowerman at University of Oregon.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Nike got into the game right at the right time, as you mentioned earlier, with the Me Generation and this focus on fitness. And I think one of the things that Nike did so well was that they were able to capitalize on the willingness of people to invest in elite athlete level footwear. And then in addition to doing that, so not only, you know, Bill Bowerman creating this incredibly light sole, doing so in a way that makes for a great story.
Using a waffle iron.
But also making the upper bright blue with an incredibly visible yellow swoosh on the side allowed for this athletic shoe to segue into fashion. And so somebody who might go jogging, say, in the morning in a pair of these could likewise wear, if not that exact pair, a similar pair to a discotheque in the evening. And so it did help to make sneakers much more visible, return them to items of status. And it also happened to be happening in the 70s, which really did see a huge shift whereby inner city athletes begin to get sneaker deals, such as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Walt Frazier. And when those shoes come out, such as the Puma Clyde, they become, as has already been discussed by Michael, you know, sort of badges of honor. And so you begin to have the ideas of urban identity being linked to the signature shoes of specific athletes really taking hold in the 70s. And then with the Air Jordan, it becomes a kind of watershed moment in which it's brought to the much wider public. And I also would just like to point out that one of the things that I think is so interesting about the Air Jordans in particular is that they are numbered. And I think that when you begin to number something, you begin to create anticipation. And I also think it is mirrors in some ways the fashion season. I mean, here you're waiting for the next basketball season, but this anticipation and a collecting mentality of I need one, then I need two, then I need three, I think fit very well with the times and ultimately created this brand, the Jordan brand, where it's still being numbered and people still want to augment their collection with the next one.
Right. Nike seems really genius in terms of numbering its shoes, like you said, creating anticipation, and also in terms of never quite selling enough to meet demand. Michael Denzel Smith, does that work on you? The limited releases, the anticipation.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, but I also am at a point, you know, I don't want everything just because it's the newest and the latest one. You know, I am more interested in curating the things that appeal to me most and speak to me and my identity. What is most reflective of who I am? And the Air Jordan line is certainly still, and you know, the production of retros because those are the sneakers that we hold. It's like the sort of the grail, right? It's like 1 through 14, and most of that being designed by Tinker Hatfield. You know, and that being the bulk of Michael Jordan's career, his years as a Chicago Bull, and everything that we watched him do in those sneakers, and being drawn to that, and feeling wanting to feel that greatness. I mean, when I was writing my book, like when I needed inspiration, I put on like YouTube of Michael Jordan clips. Like that was what I was trying to feel. And I try to feel that now by just wearing the sneakers.
We're talking about sneakers, their cultural significance, their role in major pop culture moments, their enduring appeal, and with the people who covet them. The Oakland Museum has a new exhibit featuring about 150 sneakers from the 19th century to present day. Join our conversation. Why do you love sneakers? What do they say about you? What are your questions for people who do love them? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions to forum@kqed.org, post them on our website, on Facebook, or you can tweet us at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us.
Great defense starts with your feet. And I have MVP feet. That's why I plan to pump from Reebok. When I'm pumped up, I get support, protection, and a custom fit that's unbeatable.
I'm a hot dog, but when it comes to protection, this is no bull. Pump up and air out.
Switch to the greatest sports performance shoe in the world, the Reebok Pump. Pump up and air out.
That's, of course, an old commercial for the Reebok pump. I think that featured Dennis Rodman. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum, and we're talking with Michael Denzel Smith, author of The Invisible Man. Invisible Man Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education, with Elizabeth Semmelhack, curator of the exhibit The Rise of Sneaker Culture, now at the Oakland Museum of California, and with Stephen Smith, design director of Yeezy Lab, Kanye West's collaboration with Adidas. He's also designed footwear for Fila, Reebok, Adidas, and Nike. And Stephen Smith, you were talking earlier about the kinds of things that brands are going for with their shoes. What was Reebok going for with the pump?
You know, with the pump, it was improved fit, and it was an interesting solution. You know, we surrounded the foot with a cushion of air, and as you pumped it up, you could adjust whether it was tight or loose and how you wanted to wear it. And if you needed more support, you could inflate it more. And it was, I think it was pretty revolutionary. And at the time, those things were like gold. I mean, I used to trade them for all kinds of stuff to people in other industries because they'd be like, can you get me those? And I'm like, well, you know, I'll see what I can do. And what do you got that you want to trade me? And, you know, they became like a currency almost for a while.
And, of course, you designed the Instapump Fury, which was, I don't want to say an offshoot, but you took new technology, right, and we're really kind of trying to capitalize on people's desire to have new modern technology related to space and all the stuff that was hot in the late 80s.
You know, it was
early 90s.
Interesting project in that, you know, again, like I said before, what drives me is how can I make something better, not just new and different? And this was a great opportunity to do almost like an opus work of, okay, I can take out the weight, I can improve the fit, I can reduce componentry, I can throw much better materials in there by using less of other things. And when I looked at the shoe, the typical running shoe that we had, there were something like 150 parts. By the time we got that shoe into production, we had it down to 30 parts. So we reduced the overall amount of components, but then were able to reinvest that money into the technology itself. And when I saw the original pump basketball shoe, we were creating a regular traditional shoe and then putting the air bladder up inside of it. And I'm like, well, why are we doing that? Couldn't we just take away the shoe and make this air fit system the whole shoe and then just add like a little toe protection and a little heel comfort and that would be it? And people are like, whoa, that would be really interesting. So it became this kind of epic project because we had to re-engineer the pump system, and then on top of that, I wanted to remove all that weight through the midsole, so we cut out the whole center section of the midsole, removing a third of it, so that removed a third of the weight. And at the time, carbon fiber was this really cool aerospace material where people were like, what, you want to put that in a shoe? Are you out of your mind? And so we replaced that piece of midsole, which normally supported your foot, with this really unique aerospace material that they were using in Formula One cars and fighter jets and spacecraft. And we also used Hexalite, which was the cushioning system, which was an offshoot of how they build helicopter blades. That's the core that's normally in a Nomex paper that's inside of a helicopter blade that's then skinned with either carbon fiber or aluminum. And that was a weight reduction for strength substitute, and that's what we put in it. So when this thing came out, we had addressed every component of the shoe with something really radical and science-based, and it created this whole new aesthetic and this whole new product where people are like, what on earth is that? And, you know, we showed it to Paul Fireman. He was like, holy crap, guys, that was it. Go, make it.
Yeah.
And it was pretty revolutionary. I mean, at the time, we got Popular Science Best of What's New Award, which was pretty cool. It showed up in all these aerospace magazines. And one of the other things that was pretty unique about it is the carbon fiber piece. At the time, when we were first starting the project, we went to a bunch of aerospace companies and was like, can you make this part for us? And they're like, you know, we make fighter jets, you know. What do we want to make sneaker parts for? And like, well, how many of those you make a year? Well, like 100. And it's like, what if you made 100,000 or like 500,000 of these things? And they're like, yeah, I don't know. We're comfortable, fat, and happy with our fighter jet program. And so we went to another company, Hexcel, based in California, and we're like, hey, we knew they had made skis in the 70s, and we're like, what do you guys think? You know, like, oh, we'll take a shot at it. And basically, we didn't know it at the time, but that program bailed that company out of near bankruptcy and turned them into a highly profitable company again. And they took the risk of going into the sporting goods business instead of staying tied to those government contracts. And the other guys who told us no, you know, a year or two later when the government contracts went away, were like knocking on our door. We're like, yeah, sorry, go talk to Hexcel. You know, they took the risk with us.
Well, Ben says, though I think the prices paid for these sneakers is ridiculous, I do remember my Patrick Ewings with the pump fondly. I always thought of sneakers as the shoe of the future. From Back to the Future to The Fifth Element, sneakers have always been the clothing identified with the cutting edge. We're joined right now by Chantel Martin. She's an artist who's based in New York, and she does black and white drawings, and she's done them on one-of-a-kind sneakers, and they are actually on display at Out of the Box, the exhibit at the Oakland Museum. Good morning, Chantel Martin.
Cool, good morning. I'm actually in L.A. today, but, you know, so nice change of scenery.
Oh, good. Well, after hearing all the description of the thought that goes into the design of a shoe from Stephen Smith, I can understand why you say that they are an incredible canvas to work on.
Yes, you know, it's like architecture for the body. You know, it's a canvas that you can, you know, especially as an artist, show and wear and expose to the world, and kind of, you know, in that way, like you say, be proud of it. You know, everyone looks at your feet, and if you can wear architecture or, you know, wear your art as an artist on your feet, you know, that's it's a great way of starting conversations and a great way of showcasing what you do.
But you strip the shoe completely of color and any brand signifiers. What's behind that?
You know, it's just, it's more about stripping it back to the blank canvas. You know, I don't make shoes personally, but I want to use what I have access to. And, you know, there's people already out there making really beautiful, you know, shaped shoes. So I you know, I find a really beautiful shape that I like, and I strip it of branding, and I strip it of any color, I strip it of any identifiers, and then I build it back up to be, you know, to kind of fit into my identity and my fingerprint and my style as an artist. But, you know, kind of using what you have access to and as a resource.
I was intrigued by the fact that you also described doing that as, in some way, making it accessible, that anyone could do this. To some degree.
Yeah, you know, yeah, completely. So, you know, people think, well, you know, I'm not one of these major big sneaker brands. I can't ever make my own shoe. But, you know, I don't either. So, but I can go and find a shape that I like, and I can strip it back, and I can draw on it, I can paint it. And, you know, it's funny because I meet people everywhere, you know, in elevators, on the subway, on the street. And everyone is like, oh, my God, I love your shoes. And I'm like, well, you know, I have one of my pens on me. Like, here's a pen. You have it. Like, you draw on your own shoes. And, you know, it's fun in that way. You know, you're kind of treating it like, you know, we're all big kids. Like, we can decorate our own stuff if we want. It's super accessible. You know, there's no barriers between it. And I think some, you know, we forget that sometimes. We make these things seem way overcomplicated and unobtainable. But, you know, we can just take a pen and draw on anything. And we can draw on our shirts, we can draw on our jackets, we can draw on our shoes.
Forgive me, are you commenting in some ways on the inaccessibility, too, of sneakers, that they are only accessible to those who can afford to shell out hundreds of dollars?
We're in this place now where, you know, it's like, it's all about how exclusive it is, or it's a, you know, it's a limited edition color, or it was a limited edition run, or, you know, it's all these tiers of inaccessibility which make it important. And I'm all about just stripping that back and making it accessible. You know, it's a plain shoe, it's a nice shape, I've drawn on it, and I've made it relevant to me and my life and what I'm doing. You know, I put questions or thoughts or wrote things on my shoes that might relate to people around me, you know, and it doesn't need to be this like super limited edition crazy thing that is like an insider game. You can make it an outsider thing.
And a quick example of something you've written on the shoe?
Do you read?
Well, Chantal Martin, I want to thank you for talking with us. Thanks so much.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me.
Chantal Martin, an artist based in New York who's in L.A. today. Her black and white drawings are on one-of-a-kind sneakers at the Out of the Box exhibit at the Oakland Museum. And let's hear now from Kevin in Oakland. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for having me on. I just want to say first, note of disclosure, I had the graphite Jason, the carbon fiber Jason Kidds in ninth grade, and I would say still that the 1995 Nike Air Max in silver and red has to be one of the best shoes ever designed. Any price that anybody pays for it is worth it. That being said, I just want to go ahead and congratulate Michael Denzel Smith. I'm pretty sure I heard him a little bit ago talking about his knowledge and his awareness of shoe culture. But I just wanted to say, I just wanted to really appreciate all your guests who are there. My question is kind of simple. It's a question and a comment, and I think anybody can answer it, but it's really directed to Mr. Smith. I would like to know what your thoughts are as far as the role that recreational equipment and athletic equipment play in our, let's say, as black folks or as urban folks or as low-income people in general, in our perception of what luxury, leisure, the freedom to use our time how we would like and the ability to relax means to us in comparison to a lifestyle and a history that has largely put us in work boots and work clothes, heavy clothing that might be uncomfortable, but it's also very durable, but it's also very, it's conspicuously indicative of a lower income situation, how those things might contribute to our current understanding of what our real options are for growth. In short, do you believe that the culture around athletic shoes, let's say, for instance, Yeezy, is something that offers a possibility to benefit the groups that it's targeted towards, young black boys in general?
Kevin, thanks. Michael Denzel Smith.
Wow, that's I hadn't really thought about the connection until he said that, and I appreciate the very thoughtful comment and question. But as I am thinking through certain ideas around recreation and why then basketball sneakers in particular become so valuable, particularly to young black boys, and thinking about where one has access to recreation, right? And typically in an inner city, the things that you need for like baseball, right? You need a bat, you need gloves, you need ball, you need a field. You need, like, all of these things are just like they feel out of reach. You can't participate in things and all of these differences. But basketball, there's a court somewhere. And you just pick up a ball and there it is. And you have a social activity for you and your friends that is outside of school, that is outside of work, and where you can feel a sense of freedom, right? You feel a freedom of expression. You feel a freedom of communion with other people who you relate to. And I think that, that's one, what drove so much of the interest in the game of basketball is the access to it in inner cities. And then as the NBA and professional basketball and more money became involved, seeing it as an escape from these conditions. But then what else is necessary, or what helps you become better but the sneaker. Like the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's and the Clyde, the Walt Flaziers, and then eventually the Jordans and everything that follows become really important in terms of I have access to something that is outside of what feels like my daily life and the drudgery of it. And that drudgery being traced back to, segregation and redlining and lack of economic opportunity and dilapidated schools and all of these things. Here is the space that exists outside of all of that whereby I feel the most free. And what can I do that allows me to be in touch with that feeling all the time is wear my sneakers.
And I want to thank Kevin for the call. And we're talking about sneakers, about why they're worthy of observation, study, and appreciation, why they're at the Oakland Museum of California in an exhibit called Out of the Box that actually runs through April 2nd. And the stories that they tell us about race and class, identity, and even gender. Carl tweets about his Converse. He says, for me, his shoes were in early 60s Chicago. It was Converse canvas tops. And another listener tweets, seems like sneaker culture is male-dominated. Have the ladies been underappreciated here? And Elizabeth Semmelhack, can you comment on this? One of the things that spurred your interest in sneakers was gender and the dynamics of gender that they seem to play a role in.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the origin of the exhibition, aside from the fact that I'm a shoe historian and I had to, of course, at some time look at sneakers, but I had noticed, a couple years into my tenure at the museum, that people started to ask me, in social events, what I did for a living. I said I worked at a shoe museum, and they said, oh, that must be for women only. And I thought that that was a very strange thing to comment on, given that gender is not constructed in our society by men not wearing shoes and women wearing shoes. And so this idea that somehow women were biologically driven to be shoe obsessed really started to rankle me. And so I thought looking at sneaker culture might be an opportunity to look at a form of footwear that was directly linked to constructions of masculinity. And so I did have this as a lens for working on this exhibition. However, it's also true that we have had historically a very difficult and complex relationship with the idea of femininity and athletic ability. And so even though women have worn sneakers, have been required to have sneakers for gym class for decades, the idea of a woman setting an athletic fashion, I think we still haven't reached that point. We don't have female superstar athletes. We have female superstar athletes, but we don't have them getting sneaker deals that are changing or exciting sneaker culture yet. And this difficulty between femininity and athleticism has played out, for example, in that pair of 1920 sneakers that you mentioned, the high-heeled sneakers. And you see the idea of this conflict playing out with the design of sneakers, sometimes including high heels, such as the pair from the 20s, but you have that repeated again and again and again, most recently with the sneaker wedge that was so popular a couple years back. And so what I argue is that these sneakers that incorporate elements of traditional feminine footwear allow women to, as I say, flirt with sneaker culture without fully letting them into it. And so, the most desirable sneakers in sneaker culture have until recently been made only in men's sizes. And so that's a very direct way of keeping women from fully participating. But there's been an outcry about it. And so I think that Air Jordans are now available in women's sizes. And I think that we may see a dramatic shift, but I agree that the focus of sneaker culture has been more related to masculinity than it has been to femininity.
I also thought your point in your essay about how sneakers are, loud, colorful, saying we're present, we're here, right, also plays with traditional notions of masculinity, and that in some ways it's like the tie, where it's a place where men can express themselves and still be masculine.
Well, what I think actually happens is that, in the 1980s, we sort of covered this a little bit, Casual Friday basically threatens the established order of the suited white businessman being the image of masculine success. We have California tech geniuses showing up to board meetings in playground clothing, their sneakers contrasting quite dramatically with the business brogue and sort of suggesting this is part of a new world order. We had in the 80s the rise of important athletes such as Michael Jordan, likewise suggesting that masculinity or idealized masculinity was going to change and that it was often going to be sneaker wearing. And so as these things began to chip away at what we image socially as dominant male masculinity, the suited white businessman, sneakers began to offer men the opportunity to express a bit of individuality about themselves. And so we see that today, that you know, sometimes the garments that men are wearing are lacking in bright colors and maybe are similar one to another, even if it's just t-shirt and jeans. But their choice of sneaker is where they can take their greatest sartorial risks with color, and also it can establish something about individuality.
And speaking of, Jennifer writes, apologies for my ignorance of basketball culture, but it would be nice to hear why the NBA banned Air Jordans. And it was because of the color, correct, that the black and red was not allowed under NBA regulations at that time. Stephen Smith, I think you were chiming in there. And one of the questions I actually had for you was whether or not there is a push to try to offer more product to women related to sneakers.
Well, I'll say, you know, the collectability and cultural status is a male side of it. But, you know, working at Reebok all those years in the 80s, we were perceived as a women's company because of the aerobics boom and fitness craze. That made Reebok, at one point, between that and Pump, we passed Nike as number one in, like, 1991. And it was driven by women. It was a huge part of our business, and for years, until the Pump came out, we were perceived as a women's brand. Even most recently, Reebok has always tried to regain some of that as it lost market space through the Spartan race and some of the things they've done to try to get back into gyms. And then I think on the running side of things, not many people realize it, but through the latest generation of runners, it's actually, I think it's almost close to a 60% split favoring women on running product in the marketplace.
And forgive me for interrupting, Stephen Smith, but I do need to remind our listeners that you're listening to Forum, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. Stephen Smith, go ahead and continue with your thought.
So the running business itself is now more female dominant due to cause running and fun runs.
And Stephen Smith is a designer for Adidas, Fila, Reebok, Nike. We're also talking with Elizabeth Semmelhack, who is curator of The Rise of Sneaker Culture, which is now at the Oakland Museum of California. And she's senior curator at the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto. We also have Michael Denzel Smith on the phone with us. He's author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. And he himself has a collection of what, Michael Denzel Smith, upward of 200 pairs of shoes. Is that right?
Some like that. I've lost count at this point.
One of the things that I found interesting in the article that the New York Times did about your shoe collection was that you mentioned something that I've heard other people say about why the shoes are meaningful. And it's in part because their parents refused to buy them when they were a child, or they didn't have the means to buy them when they were a child. One of our news editors had mentioned to me that he could mark a good financial year by the years he got a new, that he could mark his dad's good financial years by the years he got a new pair of sneakers that he actually wanted. Does that play plays a big role in it, I imagine, for you, Michael Denzel Smith?
Yeah, sort of that wish fulfillment, you know, that these are something that you coveted as a child, didn't have access to, whether that be because of a lack of funds or, in my case, just because my parents like didn't like them or didn't want to spend the money on them. You know, and the feeling, the sense that you missed out on something, and you're trying to connect to that feeling again as an adult when you make your own purchase decisions. So yeah, I mean that definitely and nostalgia. Culture driven by nostalgia. And so now that I have the means and Nike releases the retros, I can get all of those mid-90s sneakers, the big, chunky, bulky soles and everything that, like, I really wanted and make me and I'm nostalgic for in opposition to what's happening now with sneaker, like basketball sneakers and the LeBron line, which isn't as appealing to me. Or what, you know, I like the things that remind me of my childhood, as most of us do.
Well, speaking of retro, a listener writes, how has the recent oversaturation of the sneaker market with retro releases, especially the Jordan brand, changed sneaker culture? Stephen Smith?
Oh, I was going to say, I've got a great story for Michael. When I started at Reebok 89 and then into 90, across the street was a little shop that set up that sold closeouts from all the different sneaker shops and big box retail place. And they had pallets of Jordan 1s in the Carolina blue and white and the red and black, $14.99 a pair.
Wow. Well, how has the recent oversaturation of the sneaker market, or at least oversaturation to this listener, you know, with retro releases, changed sneaker culture? Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think what it's...
Elizabeth Semmelhack?
Just very quickly, I think that what it has done is encourage more people to get into the sneaker game. And so you have more designers, more collaborations. And so I think that it as individuality increasingly becomes important, we are seeing more and more people enter into, as I said, the sneaker game.
Stephen Smith, you had some thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, we're one of the few industries that can sell our Model T right alongside our latest, you know, latest and greatest hybrid car. You know, look at the Chuck Taylors. It's a throwback, but it's made exactly the same way it was for 100 years, and it's selling right alongside the latest high-tech Prime Knit and Yeezy shoes. It's crazy. I mean, we have that luxury, and, you know, the car industry can't, because that's what I always equate us to, because we create these objects of desire for people. And by having the throwback ones, those ones that you've always desired, or the younger kids see the pictures of Run DMC in these shoes and like, oh, man, it'd be great if I could get that again. They can. And that's what's pretty cool about it, is that accessibility of it all.
All right, Michael Denzel Smith, we have seconds left. What's the shoe you really want right now?
The Nike is releasing an Air Jordan 1 Retro in the black and royal blue that I'm really looking forward to this year.
Michael Denzel Smith, author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching. Thanks for being with us.
And
thank you. Thanks also to Elizabeth Semmelhack, curator of The Rise of Sneaker Culture, which is now at the Oakland Museum of California until April 2nd, and Stephen Smith, design director of Yeezy Lab, Kanye West's collaboration with Adidas. Thank you all. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, Susan Britton, and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And Holly Kernan is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.